So this is, these are plans that kick in the 2010 to 2013 period. And here you'll see what we're attempting to do is to build on the work we've done previously. This is not like any major deviation from the work that we're doing. And you'll see that all our strategic goals have to do with building our capabilities, building our capacities to deal with all of those statutory obligations in a very kind of intelligent way, in a way that is effective. And the first of these is for us to understand as an institution that we are now in a place where we must achieve demonstrable outcomes. This is the core from the general population. We're doing all this work, but, you know, what is the effect of it? Where, you know, how are we benefiting from it? And for our purposes, this requires that we consistently evaluate our work in an honest way. We continue to hone in on the prioritization process and how we prioritize what we see as important and not important, and how we go about measuring impact. How do we understand the impact of our decisions in terms of kind of reaching end consumers in particular, which is what the call is from the general population. I'll talk in more detail around each one of these. So the second one is about building strategic partnerships to promote competition. This is where we now are wanting to become more proactive in our engagements with other stakeholders, in particular government departments and organized sections of business. And then the third of the strategic goals is about developing the organization, the agency, to be a far more effective agency to what is known in the literature as a high performance agency. And this is, you know, building further on our organizational integrity, ensuring efficiency in our business processes, ensuring that our decision making is effective, and investing in staff development, ensuring that our strategy is aligned, our activities are aligned to the strategy, and to make the organization a more responsive organization to be able to respond to needs as they arise. Now, this slide kind of just stylizes all these points and looks at the three main strategic goals and what are the implementation plans we have around each of these. I must repeat once again, you see that a lot of these activities are cross-cutting activities. They're not just, I'm making the point again, we need to distinguish between our statutory obligations and what we do in a strategic plan. And what we do in the strategic, the statutory obligations are given, we have to do it. The strategic plan overlays over all of the must-do activities as per the legislation and strengthens our ability to do those better, to do those more wisely, to do those more effectively. So all of these issues that you see here are activities in the organization that strengthens our ability to do to fulfill our statutory obligations. So around achieving demonstrable incomes, you'll see, you know, there has been a lot of discussion around what really the impact of our decisions has been, and we want to understand that more deeply ourselves. We want to be able to prioritize sectors so that we essentially, in an organization like ours, we have to make choices all the time about what is more important and what is less important. We don't have kind of unlimited resources. We have to kind of decide what is the wise thing to do on a daily basis almost. And so we want to be able to kind of develop ways of prioritizing that are legit, that are defensible and objective. And we want to be ready now, after all the experience we've had, to put this into some kind of guideline that becomes more part of the institutional memory of the organization, speaks to all levels of the organization. One of the other things, one of the other important things that's emerged in the recent past is the Competition Amendment Bill, and this the amendments to the Competition Act gives us the additional power of undertaking market inquiries, and we want to be able to kind of use this tool very effectively. We want to develop this tool. It's not like, you know, the first time we do a market inquiry, we do it properly. We want to be able to engage with this and develop it as an effective tool around how we use it properly for good outcomes. And I think that the big issue around demonstrable outcomes is, you know, this is a relatively new area in public policy and around how you go about assessing what your impact or outcomes are. Causality is always a problem. I mean, for example, you know, the food prices have come down recently. Can we say that that was a consequence of the work of the Competition Commission? You can, but how would you prove it? You know, for a lot of the behaviors and activities that go on in an economy, there's a lot of very complex factors that influence it, and you can't always draw a straight line saying this led to that, led to something else. There's always a whole range of different factors that influence any particular situation, and we want to kind of be very clear around how we would assess our contribution to those changes. So developing methodologies to make these assessments is a new area and something that we want to be engaging with. In terms of strategic goal 2 around increasing the competitive environment for economic activity, this, as I pointed out, is about ensuring that other parts of the economy adopt pro-competitive policies, or at least not anti-competitive policies. And we're finding it's, you know, increasingly there's a realization that that other government policy instruments play a very important complementary role to what we're doing. They can work with us or they can work against us, and we need to ensure that there's proper alignment of all these policies and practices, and that they are reinforcing to each other. And so that will lead us to some of the specific activities we set out here, which is around proactively engaging with stakeholders in order to influence how they go about developing their policies, to strengthen dialogue and advocacy work. And we've done and we're doing more and more work in this area, for example, in terms of industry associations, in terms of dealing with government departments that are involved in policy work that brings together competitors, so say the Department of Health or the Department of Minerals and Energy Affairs, that have some sort of regulatory function over the businesses in their sectors. This is also very important because I think with the Competition Amendment Bill, we would require to work much more closely with, for example, the National Prosecuting Authority, because when the criminalization aspect of the amended act kicks in, it is the National Prosecuting Authority that will proceed with criminal investigations and prosecutions. So we won't be responsible in that. So we need to kind of work very closely with other parts of government to ensure that the complementarities, the reinforcing behaviors do in fact occur. The final part of our strategic goal has to do with ensuring that the organization functions properly. That the organization, you know, this is the backbone, this is what we all rely on in terms of making good decisions. And so there's a whole range of things that we will do there. People should appreciate that in an organization like ours, we get a lot of young people coming in who are highly technically skilled, so they're really good economists or good lawyers, and as time goes on, they get promoted into higher and higher positions, and we found that these people, while they're very, you know, our staff, while they're very, very good at the technical side of their work, lack management skills, which is what is ultimately required for to ensure that an organization functions smoothly. So we put in a lot of effort into ensuring that good management occurs in the organization. We've got a huge project called the Management Development Program, where we're taking our middle layer management, who have, you know, no training in management, through the hoops in order that they develop their skills to become better managers. Also very, very important to an organization like ours is how we deal with knowledge, how we deal with information. Our decisions are only as good as the information it's based on, and we need to ensure that we have access to good, up-to-date, complete information as far as that's possible, and this goes to implementing our knowledge management system, which is something we began doing in the previous strategic plan, but we need to strengthen now. And generally, you know, we will look at other ways in terms of the governance of the organization to ensure that the quality of our decisions. So these generally, you know, there's more detail of all of this in our strategic plan. This is just a kind of broad picture of how we think around these things. And I think that, once again, it is important to know that these are cross-cutting issues. I'm not kind of, in this presentation, although I can do it, people require it, go through with you what our priority sectors are, what the big cases are. I'm not looking at that in this session. I'm looking at the kind of bigger picture issues, but I'm happy to talk about those. I think the one thing that I have to mention at a meeting like this is that in our planning, in the planning that we did, you know, as the Competition Commission became more and more well known, and as we our successes got you know, communicated through the media and people got to know more about what we were doing, there was an enormous amount of commitment from all sections of government, from the general population, to strengthen the work of the Commission. You know, I think there were at least two State of the Nation addresses by the President that mentioned that we will get additional funds, for example. We've continuously heard this from the DPI that they're committed to giving us additional funds. And one of the things that happened to us in that context is we began planning on the basis of a lot of these promises. But in between, what happened is that there was a funding crunch in government. You know, everybody had to kind of rethink how they were spending their money, and we found that we had overplanned. We had planned on the basis of getting more money than we actually ended up getting because of all of the other issues that came in between. So I should point out to you that in the current NCEF period, our plans fall short, or the finances, the money we are given, fall short of our plans by quite a substantial amount. So, of course, in a situation like this, one of two things can happen. Either we can go out and find additional money, or we should cut down on our plan and be more realistic and kind of cut the cloth, the coat, or however the same goes. Okay? So that's the situation we're in right now. This is a situation which we've explained to everybody concerned, the Minister of Economic Development understands it, and we will kind of decide how we go on this forward. I think there is a commitment from the Minister to undertake go through the kind of, in the normal course, the NPEF process to ensure that we get this additional money. But I think it's fair for me to point out at this meeting why we kind of ended up with plans that go slightly beyond the funds that we receive. I think finally, you know, just to kind of summarize some of the main points, is that our challenges going forward is around the funding issue and whether we can do all the things we set out to do on the basis of what funds are available. Most of the additional money that we require is to pay staff, because that's our biggest intellectual property. It's what's in people's heads. And of course, with an expanding staff, we need to kind of, office space becomes an issue for us, so we need to deal with that as well. And I think one of our bigger challenges is around the kinds of expectations that people have of us. You know, there are expectations from the general public, from the end consumer, the expectations from policy makers on how we can use this law and these institutions to advance whatever area of policy they are punching. The expectations from businesses, that particularly small businesses, that we will create opportunities for new entry into different markets. This will result in many different kinds of pressures being put on authorities like ours. Sometimes I think, you know, we're not naive to think that they will all take us in the same direction. Some of them will take us in different directions. You know, I think that we've often had situations where people have made calls for us to do things that go beyond our legal mandate, that we're not empowered to do in terms of the law. And in terms of the general public, you'll find that there is a fair amount of kind of cynicism around the government department being successful. People kind of, when they see you successful, they think there's a catch. There must be something wrong here for these agencies to be so successful. So these are all the kinds of pressures we will face as an organization going forward. And of course, the amendments to the Competition Act will create a new context for us to work in. Criminalization is something we need to adjust into over time, and we need to use the new powers that this Act gives us very wisely, as I suggested earlier. I'd like to stop there at this point, and I'm happy to take questions, particularly if people are interested in what our priority cases are. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. We would like to welcome the three honourable members who have arrived. That is Dr. Huang, Ms. Helen Lyne, and Ms. Pumzi Nebemo. You are welcome and you are expected to participate in this meeting. Thank you, Commissioner. I was thinking that we'll take the tribunal first. I mean, but seemingly the members have got a different idea sent by hand. It means that maybe they want to say something or they want to ask questions, and then we continue with the tribunal. Is that yes, Baba?
I'm not trying to object to the suggestion of starting the question, whatever, but I thought that it would be much more reasonable if we could get the tribunal, so that we had a rounded input of understanding the whole institution, then we can be in a position to ask questions. Some of the questions that we may file may ask me when we travel on the travel. That would be sure.
In fact, that's how the agenda is manufactured. Not only that, I did not say you must adopt it. So I think we'll continue with the agenda. But Mama, your hand was up. Maybe you covered, okay. Is the Competition Tribunal in this way?
Yes.
Maybe we'll take this opportunity to hand over to the competition tribunal to take us through. Thereafter, I will ask the members just to reserve their questions. Or we will be asking the questions after both the commissioner and the members. Thank you very much. Over.
Chair, thank you very much, and good morning to the committee. As a good tribunal, this is our first appearance before this committee, so we look forward to a long and fruitful relationship with economic development now that we are due to move over to your department on the 1st of April. Just to introduce ourselves again for those members who weren't here earlier, I'm Norman Loim, I'm the chairperson of the tribunal. I'm here with my colleague Lerota Motola, who's the registrar of the tribunal and also the registrar of the Competition Appeal Court, and I'll explain how that fits together in a moment. And I think that bearing in mind what the Honourable Ngoma was asked for, saying, how do we all fit together? I think it's very important to actually understand what the differences between these institutions. You've heard of the Commission, you've heard of the Tribunal, I've also made a mention of the Competition Appeal Court. And people frequently mix us up. And you'll often see people referring to the Competition Board, a body that no longer exists, and existed under the repeal legislation. So our brand names are perhaps not as strong in the market as they should be, although we're in the newspaper virtually every day. So what's the difference between us and what do we do? Well, a couple of years ago, somebody from an overseas visitor came to visit the commission, and he said to one of the women who was working there, he said, what is the difference between what you do as the commission and what they do as the tribunal? He said, the difference between us is that the commission, we are very young, at the tribunal, they're very old. Now, there are actually, that might be a valid superficial explanation, but the real difference between what we do is to give it a criminal law analogy. The commission is the policeman and prosecutor of the system. In other words, if you go to the charge office and say, this guy has committed the competition crime, the police station, you go and see Commissioner Shan Rambarath and his people. They are the police station. They're also the prosecutors of the system. We at the competition tribunal are the court. That's all we do. We are only the court of the system. And if you don't like our decision and think we got it wrong, you go to the Competition Appeal Court, which is headed by Judge President Dennis Davis. And they comprise judges of the High Court, who ordinarily sit on the High Court, but a few times a year hear appeals from our decision. And that's why they're the Competition Appeal Court. So we are the three, as it were, bodies of the system. And we're all quite independent one of one another, and we all see the world independently, and sometimes we even disagree with one another. Quite healthy. The system is designed to be in that way. But we have independent budgets, we run differently from one another, and we don't, in a sense, consult with one another about how we approach cases, except where in relation to the administration of the system. So, in other words, we as the tribunal then are to give it the lawyerly language, we are an independent administrative tribunal. And we hear merger cases and we hear best practice cases. That's basically what we do. That's quite simple as to what we do. How do we hear them? Well, we call the tribunal, which is because we sit in panels of three. So three people will hear a case. We have a panel of up to 10 people who can hear the cases. Seven of our people are part-time people, which means they engage in other jobs and sit from time to time in our cases. And three of us are full-time. I'm full-time, I've got two other colleagues who are there on a full-time basis. So between the 10 of us, we must hear all these cases. And in a sense, even the panels are independent of one another. In theory, I could allocate three people to hear a particular case, they could make a decision. I might think it's the most terrible decision in the world, but they're entitled to do so. In a sense, we operate like a court in that way. They make their decision. Somebody thinks the decision is bad, be it the commission or be it a private party, they can take them and appeal to the appeal court. We also deal with merger activities. We clear mergers over a certain size. What are called large mergers come to us automatically. But the commission gives us a recommendation. So that means they are like the prosecutor. They say, we think you should be dealing with this with a merger. We think you should clear the merger. We think you should prohibit the merger. We think you should approve the merger subject to these conditions. The parties to the merger are entitled to say, commission's got it wrong, we think you should clear our merger without conditions, or we think it should go ahead. Generally speaking, if the commission clears the merging parties, unless it's a hostile merger, are not going to disagree with the commission on that basis. But we had occasion, the famous gold mining merger between which Harmony was trying to take over Goldfield, where the commission recommended approval of the merger, and Goldfield, which was trying to avoid being taken over, opposed the merger. So, Nothing is predictable in this particular line of business. Go to our next slide. I think Shan has talked to you about what the practices are. The main ones, I'll just remind you again, are cartel activity, what we call horizontal and shifted practices. And the second important one is abuse of dominance. The one, in other words, what's the difference between the two? Fundamentally, when a firm behaves like a monopoly, we talk about it being a dominant firm. Strictly speaking, an economist wouldn't let me get away with that criticism, but that's more or less how we understand that to be. In the case of a cartel, the firms themselves can't exercise market power on their own like a monopoly. So in order to get that market power, they must reach agreements between themselves to either set prices or to divide markets. But essentially, the problem, the economic problem they cause, is exactly the same as to whether it's an abuse of market of a dominant position or cartels. All of them have the ability to exploit the consumer by exercising market power to the consumer's detriment. I'm coming here today. Shan presented you with a very impressive strategic guideline. Now, I'm coming here today, which will sound heretical to the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee, to say we have no strategic plan. And why is that? Are we not doing our job? Should we all be fired by our new minister when he starts on the 1st of April? The reason is that we are an adjudicative body. If an adjudicative body had its own agenda, it would be highly detrimental to parties who had appeared before that if we already had our idea. If there were 6 people in the cement industry, 7 people in the bread industry, and we had a plan which actually said that. So our agenda really is determined by our users. Who are our users? They are the Competition Commission, who bring most of our cases to us. But even if the Competition Commission doesn't bring cases to us, private parties may bring cases to us as well. And they can do it so in 3 instances. One is what's called an intermediate merger, which is a smaller category of merger, which the Commission can approve, doesn't need to come to us with that. If people are unhappy with the decision and want to appeal their decision, they can come to us. Then we have what is called an interim relief situation. That's an urgent application where a private party who wants to get urgent relief from us while the Commission is still investigating it can come along to us and bring the case for a decision for an order that lasts up to 6 months. Although we've got this in the Act, it's very rarely used. We have one coming up in our entire program for this coming year. It's not often used because competition cases don't lend themselves to an urgent application thing that's capable of too complicated. And finally, complaint referrals. Private parties, if the Commission does not want to refer the case, are entitled to, if the Commission has investigated and decided not to refer, bring a private prosecution themselves. And sometimes there have been very, very significant cases. You may recall that there was a case brought against the Carl Steele a few years ago by Harmony Gold Mines alleging excessive prices. That was brought at a time not by the Commission, but Harmony Gold Mines, and we found that there had been excessive price. The case was taken on appeal. We were told on appeal that our legal test was wrong and we applied a different legal test. And in the interim, the party settled, so that's the case went away. So that's an example of a case that gets brought by a private party. We usually have at least one or two cases brought by a private party. They tend to be abuse of dominance cases because it's very, very expensive for a private party to bring such a case. Ordinary person in the street is not likely to bring such a case, although that happens as well. How do we prioritize that? Strictly speaking, we don't sit there and prioritize it as the Commission has done. But what we do is that when we have merger cases, according to the statute, must be prioritized. They have to be heard within a certain period. And once they've been heard, we have to give an order within a certain period. And then we have to give our reasons for that decision within a certain period. That's largely because merger activity is regarded as not inherently unlawful or necessarily problematic, and therefore we shouldn't be interfering with merger activity for too long. And that's why mergers are given a priority in the Act. As far as prohibitive practice cases are concerned, we've frequently been in a position where, in a sense, we wait for the parties rather than them waiting for us. But I think it, to the extent that it came that our role got too clogged up, I think we would respect the approach that the Commission has taken in terms of its prioritisation, because it is the public prosecutor. So in other words, if the Commission had a priority area and somebody else had come with a private prosecution, we would look and say, look, the public prosecutor should be given the first place in the queue rather than somebody else. But so far in our history, we haven't yet had a bump of somebody else at the expense of the Commission or vice versa. Generally speaking, lawyers' diaries still run the agendas of these organisations, and it's as much the Commission's lawyers as the other party's lawyers who should be blamed in any instance when we set the matter down. But it is a problem in the system that cases are not being processed as quickly as they can. It's something that we are trying to look at in the Commission as well. These cases take a very, very long time to get resolved from when they first arrive in the system, unless there's been a settlement with the Commission. Trend in large mergers is just shown on this particular slide, and you'll see that there's been a growth of merger activity. I think if we came to a more recent slide, you'll see that declining slowly. So that's largely because we've redefined the threshold for larger mergers. There's a turnover and asset size threshold, so less mergers will be regarded as large mergers. But this slide historically just gives you a feel for how merger activity has grown over a certain period and how our work in that has increased. Shannon's already shown you the slide of the tribunal cases taking longer. I want to make a slightly different point about this particular slide, a more selfish one because it relates to our budget, and I want to show you that the hearing time influences our budget size. You'll see the unevenness in the number of hearing days that you'll see over this graph over this period explained, but I'll get to later as to why we run sometimes on the surface and sometimes with a deficit. We cannot predict as to what's going to happen. So for instance, the Commission can have a case set down for 20 days, and on day one of the case, they'll come hand in hand with these fellows who they were calling cartelists, etc., etc., and other room names, and say, we've settled the case, we're all good friends here. You would have to be 20 days out of your life anymore. We'll finish by tea time. And that's a good thing in the system. We encourage settlement, but it can sometimes go out in diary. Turnaround times for mergers. I mentioned earlier that we have to meet certain target dates for setting down mergers, and we're about 80% of that. Then we've got to get our order out within 10 days. 10 days at the end of the hearing, we've given order as to whether we approve, prohibit, or condition the merger. And within 20 days of that, we've got to give a reason. Why did we give that order and explain it? Now, you'll notice there is a bit of a disjuncture here. We are very good at getting our orders out on time. We almost get a first for setting it down within the target, and we get a very poor third for our getting our reasons out on time. Let me explain to you why that is. Hearings set down within the target time, we have to set them down either to have the hearing itself or to have what we call a pre-hearing within the target date. Sometimes the parties are not worrying themselves in that period. That probably accounts for the 20% of which we don't get within that period of time. Orders, as you see, we won't manage to get out on time. Reasons lag badly. The reason for that isn't we have to give reasons in every single case. 96% of the cases are approved without either prohibition or a conditional approval. And so what we've tended to do is we've prioritized, and we prioritize decisions that hurt, that people might want to take us on appeal, either the Commission or the private party, and we tend to give these rather anodyne reasons for approval of the mergers less priority. And so in some sense, we sometimes don't always meet that target date of 20 days, and that's why we get a lower third for that. So it's not particularly exciting decision only the people who merge and pass their mothers will actually bother to read these decisions. They're fairly straightforward reasons, fairly obvious. And that's why that figure is, but it doesn't look good. But it's not a serious problem, I'll suggest. What are we doing in 2010 and 2011? Well, firstly, Sharon has mentioned the amendment to the Competition Act that came through. Just as a point of information, although the Amendment Act has been presented to by the President in, I think it was August last year, the Act has to be proclaimed to come into force. It's not yet in force. And so I thought it's time that it's actually being proclaimed, or some sections of the plan, up to the President to decide how they want to do that. That yet hasn't yet come into force, but if it comes into force in the course of this year, we'll not only have implications for the Commission, we'll also have adjudicative implications for ourselves, because there will be, my experience over 10 years in this business, every time you amend the Act, there are new challenges, and lawyers will think of new ideas to why the Act doesn't apply to them or should be interpreted differently. So that's going to impose challenges to us. It doesn't mean that we mustn't face those challenges, or we won't do so, but those will come down the road to us. And criminalisation will be one of those things that will possibly have an implication for the way we decide cases as well. On the administration front, we are introducing what is called a case document management system, which is going to improve the kind of information we're able to do about our cases and improve the information we're able to get to other stakeholders about what's going on in our sector. We get a lot of good information to sort of help improve. So it's a big investment for us over the next 3 years, which we're going to introduce soon. Just to go through what's on our role for 2010 and 11. Our role at the moment is booked up until, I think, sort of mid-September this year. So we booked quite ahead, we booked quite far in advance. So these are a couple of cases that will be coming up on our role that have been set down. So for instance, there is a case that a small distributor, Coca-Cola, has bought against that company, and in the right-hand column we've the number of days that we set the matter down. The Commission versus Astral affects that involves the poultry industry and a joint venture between Astral and one of its erstwhile friends in the industry, which has now become hostile. They're alleging that the joint venture was a cartel. Case against the Commission is brought against Sasol and other fertilizer industry. There is price discrimination and abuse of dominance case as well. The Rockler case is an alleged case of price fixing in the construction industry. That set out for 9 days. The biggest case that will be coming up this year is a case of the Commission is bringing against South African Brewery. It involves a number of different aspects of the case. It involves alleged horizontal restrictive practices, resale price maintenance, abuse of dominance. In other words, the Commission has come with the entire charge sheet in the book against the thing. As a result, it's got 40 days allocated. It's the longest case sheet for the year. It's going to be quite detailed. It may even take more than 40 days. Then DPR Plastics is a case involving plastic pipes. Again, it's a cartel case. We've set 9 days for that. That's sort of a feel for what we've got on the role this year. So you'll see in those cases that there are mainly abusive dominant cases and cases in which collusion is alleged. That they involve the food industry. I'm assuming that people consider beer to be food as well. So the food industry, and it involves the construction industry. And that very much fits the priority areas that the Commission has, although it will talk about if you want to ask them about that, but not surprising if those are the cases that are coming through the system. Just to then get onto our finances, how do we fund our activities? Largely through filing fees that we get from mergers. There are filing fees for hybrid tax cases. They are very small. They are inconsequential. The grant that we used to get from DTI, and hopefully we'll get from Economic Development now, and I've put it with a question mark, accumulated surplus, because it's been sort of an issue between us and the Treasury over the years, that we've accumulated surpluses, and we have said if we can get our surpluses, we can carry on running our business, can get them from them, and sometimes It's taken a while to get that consent, and it's not clear from time to time as to whether we'd be actually entitled to it. So you may say, why do we get the surplus? And if I can remind you again of that slide we saw earlier of the unevenness in the number of cases. The reason we get a surplus here is that over the years our income has exceeded our expenditure. So our income has been 117 million, our expenditure has been 97 million over the 10-year period, and we've had a surplus of 19 million at the moment. And that's because it's been impossible to budget exactly because we are a reactive body, It depends on what the Commission is doing, what people are putting onto our agenda. We cannot determine that agenda ourselves. The best we can do is saying, historically we've had X number of court days. Going forward, we expect it more or less the same. Some years we get it right, some years we get it wrong. But will we need to retain our surplus? And the answer is yes, we will, because if you're going forward over the period, we expect to around 2012, over the 3-year period, we would expect to leave that surplus. We would have a shortfall starting in 2010-11, 2011-12, and 2012-13. And so we would like to be able to get Treasury to say, look, we understand your problem, you can keep your surpluses. If we can keep those surpluses, we see ourselves functioning. We have an organisation, as you'll see, with a pretty small budget. We are around 20 million a year, going up slightly over the end of this period. 3-year period, we should be around 50 million. Our budget is, like the Commission's, we are very much, if you look at the personnel item, it's the largest percentage of what we're doing. Everything else is quite small. Professional services is one of these odd categories. You might wonder, are we spending 16% of our budget on lawyers? No, for some reason that's been explained to me, the DTI wanted us to classify our least expenses as professional services. Anyone who's leased the DTI campus may wonder if that's an appropriate name for professional services for the way buildings sometimes manage, but it's classified in the professional services. But if it's really leased cost, that's a slightly misleading item number. You'll see below that the appeal court is on our budget, not under justice's budget. And that's because the DTI initially helped set up the court, historically took over the budget. It's just been much easier in a sense to manage the court's budget through ours. We do not pay the judges for the work that they do. They're not given any special remuneration. So the expenses in relation to the appeal court are largely the travel expenses of the judges, some administrative expenses, and allows the judges to attend training conferences once a year. Who works for the tribunal? Finally, I mentioned earlier that we've got three full-time members, seven part-time tribunal members. The part-time tribunal members are only paid for the cases that they actually hear. As a division of labor in terms of budgeting, it works fairly well. If we look at the total that we paid for our part-time members, it's roughly equated to what we sometimes pay to a full-time member over the year. And then the remainder of our staff, our secretariat, 13 people organized in three divisions. We have a registry, which is Morocco, what all the heads up. We have our finance department, corporate services, as we call it. And finally, there are case managers who do the research for each case. Has a case manager who runs the case administratively and researches for the panel that hears the case. So that's basically who works for the tribunal. That's the environment.
Thank you very much. I didn't recognize the Honorable Amro. Honorable Amro, you are welcome. The other members were absent, but I could not see you. I saw you when you just stood up. Thank you. You are welcome to this participation. I'll ask the members to take their shots. There are many hands. I will start with the Honorable Manamela, followed to Honorable Mabaso, Honorable Cortez, number 3, number 4, Honorable Ngonyama, number 5, Dr. Rabi, number 6, Amrosin, Honorable Amrosin, number, okay. Let's take those 6 and 7. I think the best thing is because we had 2 presentations. Maybe you can say this one is to the competition and this one is to the tribunal. It will be better that way so that they can take them simultaneously. Or, yeah. That's it in that order.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We would obviously be interested in the priority areas that the Competition Commission is looking at. And I thought when you posted the rhetorical question, you actually get into it, because I think that's of much interest. And the reason why I'm raising that, firstly, is that during the Minister's or the Treasurer's budget speech, one of the issues that was mentioned or profiled was the issue of bank charges. The service charges that banks impose on their customers, and I think this has been one of the issues dominating the financial sector for quite some time, and whether has there really been collusion within the main, particularly within the main 4 banks, and I think it's one of the critical areas that I'm not sure if the Competition Commission has done any work before on the issue. Has there been any investigation? Has there been any complaint lodged with the Commission? But also, given the profile that the budget speech has given, on this particular issue, are you thinking of, looking into the whole issue of the bank charges? The other issue is around the cell phone industry, the charges that are imposed also on clients with regards to that. And I think, contrary to popular belief and what the cell phone companies would want us to believe, there is in some way an element of collision on the part of cell phone companies, even with regard to the review of the prices that was announced, which would happen progressively. And I think that's one of the things that I thought that or rather when you speak to the issue of priorities, you'd probably want to look at. Now, my concern within the context of where we are now, I mean, we're hosting the FIFA World Cup, and a major concern has been around the issue of transport and accommodation. I remember that at some point, I think about a month or two ago, there was this allegation that airlines have colluded in fixing prices. And I think it's quite a concern. And when we look at the prices of flights, international and domestic, around that period, obviously because it's a service that people definitely need, are we looking into that? Is it something that we're considering? Is it our major priority? Obviously because of the impact that it would have on the success of the World Cup in terms of people coming into the country, and I think we've had a whole range of reports with people concerned that the prices in terms of travel exorbitant, but also the prices in terms of accommodation, that some of, you know, some may not necessarily be your major, you know, providers in terms of accommodation, but that if you look at what is being charged in that period, maybe within the or under the banner of its peak season and all of that, you know, are we not, you know, looking at that? Those are the areas that I hope you probably touch on when you look into the priority.
Thank you. That was the Honorable Manamela. Number two.
Thank you for the check. I wish to express gratitude to the two presenters for the input made. But my question is the question, and at the same time, is just to say that the cost of uncovering some of the ill practices done by the role players in the economy, the cost to the public, the cost to government, are so high that I think we must always say that the deterrents are the deterrents proportionally strong versus the cost that we are incurring. Because I think in one of the implication made that some of the rich companies are so rich that when you charge them, you fine them a certain amount, it is peanuts to them. It's almost negligible when you consider what they have accumulated over the practices and what they may accumulate in the future. So that I would think the deterrent should be so strong that the objective is to prevent people from entering. It's not worthwhile. You know, they just think, no, it's not worthwhile. So is there a possibility of doing that? For an example, I mean, if you say, yes, your firm has done this, and it will no longer manufacture in South Africa. I think that's a huge cost, because it means even the capital of that firm, you know, it's a problem to that, to the owner. So if that can be considered. And then my second part is the community members. But when I say community members, I mean in a broad sense. It could be consumers, as we simplistically talk of consumers, but it could also be other friends, mostly the small ones. To what degree are they empowered so that they in turn are a tool available to yourself? Because as you pointed out, it is difficult to discover some of these ill practices. So if we don't have a community that is moving with us, we will find that it is very difficult to identify these people. The last one is how are you doing in terms of staff retention? Because I assume that the staff is a huge asset, and the training that staff is also a big exercise, so that that retention strategy has to assist the nonsense and quality.
Thank you, Honorable Mabasa. That was Honorable Mabasa. Number three.
Thank you, sir. Welcome to the question, and also to the opportunity to applaud in the commercial bank in Indonesia about the press system on equity. And I think that this is very adequate for the application of the good work of the bank. My concern is on corporate leniency. I think it is a good practice and also a cost effective. But on the other hand, will it not open up to temptation whereby companies commit crime deliberately, then come back to confess? Maybe a minimum, you know, punishment will do to appease victims. And also, it might augment your fundraising. You know, it will be a practice like a test that we see Monday to Saturday, Sunday, go to church, you confess. Monday to Saturday, on and on.
Yeah.
So if you can consider maybe applying some punishment, even if you are lenient, but there might be something that is done to them, you know, to do it again.
Thank you, Honorable Protesi. Let us protest. Honorable Ngonyama.
Thank you, Chair. Let me join the members in appreciating the and welcoming the input from the members. The first issue would be on matters relating to measures in general. It's an issue and of economic transformation or participation within the economy by those who have been marginalized. Does the Act take into consideration, or are we focusing only on price fixing and monopoly and so on and so forth, and when we consider approving or disapproving measures? Or do we take the question of bringing on board by those big companies that seek to merge those that have been in the periphery of the economy in order to enhance and the growth of the participation and of the people in general within the economy, and then be in a position to achieve transformation of our economy? The second one is the large merger trend slide. It seems that there's so much 2009-2008 approval without conditions. What is the meaning of the trend and of the slide? It's quite interesting. And what would actually this be saying to us, that there is this and the approval without conditions? Is it because of proper advocacy and information sharing, and now everybody understands and the what is required or what? But that's one. The other one is the turnaround time for measures, 52.58%. What time do we take approximately just for that 52.58? When we go back to them to give them reasons, approximately what time and does it take? Yes, I fully agree with the, I mean, we orders issued within target 100% and so on. But that 52.58, what time approximately? Is it reasonable time? The other one is, if the act was to be, the amendment was to be proclaimed during this period, there are certain challenges that you referred to. And then, Mr. Mellon, what are the challenges that we must anticipate as the Portfolio Committee and be in a position to enready ourselves and in order to assist in the process? And if we can be taken on board on that. The case for SAB and Sasol would be very much interested to understand what is the nature of these cases. And because these are two big companies in our country, and that have significant impact within the South African economy, these cases, and therefore you'd expect that these two companies would stick to corporate governance. And that would be my concern if these companies are not acting exemplary. The last one is the budget component, and the issue there is the capital component of the budget. What is involved in the capital part of it? You have here the budget for 2010-2011. We have 15.86% for capital. What is the capital here component? Just for to understand the budget. The last one, sorry, Chair, too. It's the last one. I'm sorry. It's a real last one. It's a Competition Commission as a center of information and staff morale and motivation. As a center of information, are we succeeding in realizing that objective? Because it's a very, very interesting objective. And how far do you actually go in sort of making sure that people and sort of utilize the information of the Competition Commission? And then, of course, I refer to the staff morale, and which is a very critical one for the functioning of the Competition Commission chair. What would be the reason for the staff and the demotivation if we're to refer to that?
Thank you, Honorable Ngonyama. Number five.
Thank you, Chair. My question relates to the competition. First and foremost, I think they've done sterling work. I think if we look at, in terms of Tiger Brands and Pioneer Foods and so forth, they've done a lot to further consumer protection in the country. But Chairman, I'd like to ask, especially the Commission, allegations were made. I know the retail sector is very concentrated and it's dominated by a number of role players like Pick and Pay and the Checkers Group and Spar and so forth. But food inflation is very high and allegations were made that there is price fixing at some lines. I'd like to get the view of the Competition Commission on that. And the second thing is the pharmaceutical industry. I think on one of the magazines that I read fairly recently, allegations were also made that some of the pharmaceutical companies in this country, that there is a fair degree of price fixing regarding generic medicine and so forth. I don't know whether this is true. I'd like to have the views of the Competition on that as well. And then short-term insurance, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to have the views. Do they suspect any collusion regarding short-term insurance and so forth? And then finally, Astral Foods. I'd like to have the views on the Astral Foods. I think someone mentioned, I think the tribunal mentioned here, that there was a degree of market allocation there. But again, the same principle applies to Astral Foods or Rainbow Chicken, or for that matter, all these listed companies. Astral Foods is listed, and I think Rainbow Chickens as well. I'd like to have the views on what is the background behind this particular case. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, that was Dr. Rabi. Honorable Member.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The every dialogue needs to have dissonant voice, just for purposes of dialectic. I had five engagements with the Competition Commission, the Tribunal, in the past 12 months in trade and industry. So as they move here, so do I. And in that dialogue, I've been the I've been the critical person. I've been critical because one evaluates performance by results, and I, as a consumer, constantly stumble in a marketplace which is ridden with monopolists and cartels. And that is not my saying, so IPAP tells us so. And there was awareness. We had the commission last week within the IPAP hearing, and trade and industry reiterated a request that we made some time ago, which I think should be taken up by this committee now, to have a full analysis of the competitive environment in South Africa, taking into account all those areas which are not within the jurisdiction of the Commission, because they are protected by legislation, regulations, or just government practices. Just to give an example, the sugar market. I mean, our sugar here is more expensive and our sweets are more expensive because of the Sugar Act, which imposes the legal monopoly. So I think that this should remain an item on the agenda. IPAP highlights how the competition, the lack of competition is crumbling our industry. And also areas like the IDC. I mean, the IDC has become an industrial complex, which in its own financing practices does not finance businesses which are in competition with those which it has an equity in, because there where its revenues come from. And that's another. And so we need to take a hard look. And this is my, in the banks and the airlines, and it goes on and on. So that's my comment. My question actually is about the professional fees and the rent, because that's another situation which is, I find very problematic, because I understand that DTI is renting from a private entity, and that money should go rightly into the National Revenue Fund, because all national revenue in terms of the Constitution should go into the National Revenue Fund and then retransferred back to the landlord. So I want to know whether they've looked into the issue and whether the practice is in fact consistent with the budgetary practices in the Constitution.
Thank you, Honorable Ambrosin. Let me give to
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me reiterate what my colleague said before. Sorry about that. Just want to thank you actually for the work done so far and the presentation before us. We would want to understand as to when are you expected to present your or to table your own strategy plan through the minister to Parliament. That is one, because here we are dealing with a summary. Hence members are asking this type of question. I'm referring this to both the Competition Commission and the Tribunal. The second question that I would want to ask in terms of the Competition Commission, on your slide 5, you're referring to the activities in terms of your corporate leniency applications over time by sector. And when I look at the sectors there, you have the sector written other there. What did it comprise of? Those other, because when I look at the performance here or the activity, it looks like that other is high in terms of the activity, so that we can understand what it comprises of. And I find your work since 2004 very inconsistent. What is attributable to this inconsistency? I can see that you become a bit very active around last year. If we can understand that, if it can be explained to. In terms of your strategy, you'd want to consolidate your partnerships, working partnerships with law enforcement agencies. How's your current relationship then or your partnership with them. And perhaps it would assist to give us, you know, issues that are contributing perhaps into you not realizing your turnaround time that affect that kind of partnership. I don't know whether that is clear with you. While the competition tribunal indicated their turnaround time on cases, I would also want to get a feeling from your side as to what is your turnaround time per case. I know last time you tried to give us, but it wasn't as clear as we would wanted to get it. In terms of your funding option, you say you have two options, either to cut down on plans, which I would, in terms of your challenges, you'd agree that is not advisable because there are a lot of expectations. And I don't know why that expectation is a challenge. Perhaps you need to explain to us. Because obviously, in terms of the work, the type of work you're doing, you'll always expect people to have high expectation in terms of the type of work you're doing or your return in terms of what you're doing. How is the money called surplus within the tribunal assisting you as the competition commission? I know that you are operating separately, but you are feeding each other. While you're experiencing a shortfall, they are experiencing surpluses. I will come to them in terms of that surplus because I don't understand why do they call that money a surplus, the tribunal. Why not an under expenditure? Why a surplus? I was also interested in the question that was asked by Honorable Ngonyama in terms of the large measure trends, in terms of your slide, not numbered, but it's a slide dealing with large measure trends. It will be also important to just give examples of what you're saying here. Approved without conditions, prohibited, approved with conditions. My interest here is in relation to what some of these measures are contributing towards the general economy. And if you say you prohibit, what does that impact? How does it impact on the general economy? And those conditions, how do they help? Or, you know, I'm asking this question because I'm not yet clear. We're engaging for the first time. And it will be important that we have a good understanding in terms of what you're dealing with here. And obviously, we are linking this to the general economy because we believe whatever you are doing should contribute towards the economy or should actually assist the economy. Or by assisting, what I mean is that it should secure instead of perhaps endangering. That's what I mean. I hope I'm clear enough. In terms of the tribunal's presentation, you gave us turnaround time for measures, but not for private parties. Was that deliberate? and why? I think the other question was asked by, I think it's Honorable Mabasa. I'm not going to get to that. The DCI grant, how is it accountable for that grant? Is it a conditional grant? Is it just a normal grant that doesn't need accountability? And you are talking of the accumulated surplus here. Is it accumulated over how many, over what period, for instance? Your staff complement. You're saying you have 13 in three divisions. The whole tribunal. Oh, okay. The three full-time, the seven part-time are not part of that 13. They're not. Oh, okay. So you have all in all 23.
That's okay. All right. Thank you, Honorable Coleman. That was Honorable Coleman.
Thank you, Chego, sir. I have two short questions. One is covered by my article. For this, your presentation for the why do we get the surplus? Then from your 3 years, the funding, you didn't show us for what your income, for your total income. So from here, we can't see the, you just show us for the, your expenditure and the grant. So we didn't cover for your budget. Your budget is, you make the budget all similar, 3 years all the same. But I didn't see the what your income. So how we can say you showed for the, from your surplus, deduct 3 years, you store the minus. So this one I need the more details. Then for the, my colleague to cover for the, this, for the cell phone issue. From this case for the 2010, 2011, I think your case is still didn't touch for the union wanted for strike or the nation for this regarding the ESCOM is this problem. You want to increase 25% every year for ESCOM. So you don't touch the ESCOM. They want to increase every year 25%. So I want to know. I think it's the first time last year we had to meet you together. One meeting, we also asked this question. How do you catch it for this big fat cat? Because you catch a small one, it's nothing. Like our Mabasa said. Because your budget, maybe you can't catch a big one. You only catch a small one. Okay, small one, don't come to committee, report to us. So I just want to know, ESCOM, what do you deal with this?
Thank you. That was Dr. Rabi. I mean, that was Dr. Han, sorry. I would like to add one question. I just wanted to find out from you, as the Committee on Economic Development, what would you like us, let's say when we are doing an oversight on you, what will, let's say, the priority what you would like us to do when we are doing an oversight on this commission. I mean, both of you, if you can tell us at the end that, you know, you are expecting us to do 1, 2, 3, that's where you think you've got challenges, so that you'll need our assistance. Thank you. I hope you've got enough time to respond. But we'd like to start with the competition commission.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. There's a lot of questions here, and I hope I do justice to them. I've asked our Deputy Commissioner to fill in any gaps that I might not touch on. I'm just going to take them as they came and try to deal with each one as they came. Look, the first question was about our priority areas, and I must apologize. I actually have a set of slides that are not working here now to talk through these issues. These are slides of previous presentations I've given, not to this committee, but to the Trade and Industry Committee. I've made many presentations on our past priorities. And I didn't think it was necessary to do it again, but perhaps because I'm here for the first time, it's an unwise thing. I should have done some of the history. And I must point out that in my presentation, I spoke about two sets of strategic plans, one for the period 2006 to 2009, and the other for the period 2010 to 2013. Okay? And the big point I made is that all our strategic plans for the period 2006 to 2009, we're seeing the results of those plans now. So all of the cases we have right now are as a consequence of all the planning we did in the previous period. The planning we're doing for the next period, we'll see the results forward in time. I think this is an important point and an important lesson for us, and that is, you got to see planning in time. These are multi-year commitments. They don't happen quickly. There's a lot of investment one makes in these plans in order to see them materialize. But just to very quickly go through the previous year's plans, what we did in that 2006 plan is, as I pointed out, the biggest thing we did was to prioritize our work. The question we asked ourselves is, how do we go about prioritizing the cases that we have? What criteria would we use in doing so? And we set out, and we chose four criteria on the basis of which we prioritize sectors and cases. Firstly, we were looking at those markets in which the product impacts on low-income consumers. Okay, so bread, milk, basic food stuff. We want to deal with those issues, those products that affect poorer people, firstly. Secondly, we want to deal with those issues that go to the cost of doing business. Telecommunication costs, bank charges, these are all costs that raise the cost of doing business and impacts negatively on the economy. Thirdly, and very importantly, we wanted to align our work with public policy and economic growth and development objectives. So we wanted to be aligned with the SGISA, with all the plans coming out of DTI, industrial policy. We want to be aligned, in sync with it. And fourthly, one of the important criteria for our prioritization was we looked deeply into our own experience as an institution. Where are all the complaints coming from? Who's complaining about what? So we drew on our past experience to come up with a set of important issues. What, in applying those priorities, what we came up with is four priority sectors. Firstly, agro-processing and food. So this is the food industry, and everyone would be aware of all the food cases we've had, bread, milk, beer. If you can consider that food, but also not only the end products, the inputs to the food markets, like fertilizer. Fertilizer, these are big cases because fertilizer is a big input cost to food manufacturing. The second area we came up with was infrastructure and construction, and as everyone's aware, an enormous billions of rands have been earmarked by government to develop our infrastructure. You know, not only are we talking about 2010 stadiums, but roads, dams, a lot of other infrastructure is occurring, and if the costs are high to government, the government loses out and the taxpayer loses out, so we have an important role in ensuring those costs are down. Thirdly, we prioritize intermediate industrial products. Here, we're talking basically steel and chemicals, right? These are the products, these are the intermediate products that go into manufacturing, right? The inputs into manufacturing, okay? Because that's one of the industrial policy objectives of this country, develop the manufacturing sector, and the criticism is that the input costs are high. And fourthly, the financial sector, and that's where the question around bank charges come in. Now, I can talk in some amount of detail around each of these, and there are different cases in each of these sectors that we're currently dealing with at different stages in the pipeline. In other words, you know, some of them are being investigated at the moment. Others, we've finished the investigation and we've referred it to the tribunal and a hearing is just about to happen. In other cases, the hearing is finished, the fine has been paid. In other cases, you know, our decisions have been challenged at the appeal court. So a lot of these cases are in different stages in the pipeline of these legal proceedings. There was an important question around bank charges. Do I need to go into more detail around each of these cases, each of these sectors now? Would you like me to? On each sector, I've mentioned them, but to look at the cases in them. It's a long...
From my point of view, I will say yes, because it's not often that we interact, and the better we are equipped, the more we understand each other to a certain level, that way we are able to move together. That's my proposal. Thank you. Maybe I wanted to concur with the last speaker, but maybe I can just tweak it a bit and say, if we're to get just the key principles on all these areas, as to what is your consideration when you talk about food processing, what is your key consideration when we talk about the financial sector, what are the key not necessarily getting into the details, because and the meeting will take a long time.
I'll just proceed on that basis. Okay, so in the first sector we spoke about is agro-processing in food. Now, historically, this sector in the economy is characterized by high concentration in trading, in the storage of grain, both wheat and maize, and in the processing parts of the food value chain, the milling and the baking of bread. When we approach the sector, you will all recall that one of the things that happens here when you take up a case is that there's a tendency for everybody in the value chain to blame other players in the value chain for their high costs. Okay, so, you know, that's a general tendency. And what we've done is we've looked at different food markets, and in some of them we've dealt with the entire value chain. Because in some instances, it's not like one player in the value chain is to blame. All of them have contributed in different ways towards higher prices. So a typical example would be your milling, baking value chain. So we're looking at there. We've got cases dealing with storage of grain in silos. We've got cases dealing with collusion in milling. We've got cases dealing with collusion in bread. Okay, those cases, the last one is almost finished. Those cases are old cases, but there'll be new ones coming in other parts of that value chain. But also, this general in this food industry has, a lot of firms are vertically integrated, which means that the same firm, if you look at the example I used, owns the storage facility, the milling facility, and the baking facility. So they're all vertically integrated, and this is a big characteristic of this market, and it's something that has kind of undermined government's deregulation policies, where these were meant to be separated, and one player didn't have the power it did over an entire value chain. But also we found that historically, and even up to now, a lot of the problems that arise in these sectors has occurred because government regulations, particularly the older ones, but some of them have not changed entirely, have to some extent facilitated anti-competitive behavior. The current one that we're looking at in one of our cases, for example, is fishing quotas. But in the past, when you had all the boards, the wheat board, these were kind of government-regulated structures. When government got rid of them, they got replaced by privately regulated structures, where government regulation got replaced by collusion between the firms. So in a number of markets, we're finding that is also a problem. Now, the cases we have here range from are in a wide range of product markets. The bread and milk cases you're familiar with. I've spoken about the fertilizer case, which is a major input into agriculture. In addition, we're talking about animal feed, which is linked to fertilizer production. We've cases in poultry. We've cases in fishing. Fats and oils, and as I mentioned earlier, there's a case around grain storage as well. And those are the kind of major cases in that particular area. That's in food markets. Then, if you look at the intermediate industrial product market, here I pointed out that chemicals and metals are the key inputs into manufacturing, that one of the industrial policy objectives of this country is to develop a manufacturing sector, to be less reliant on imports of manufactured goods and to produce our own. And we've seen in this sector that prices of these inputs have often, or sometimes at least, have risen at rates higher than in excess of the producer and consumer price inflation. So the prices are rising higher here than in the rest of the economy. And also in these sectors, we're also talking about historically dominant firms in very concentrated markets, often firms that are a consequence of the previous government's industrial policies. Right? So we're talking about Sasol and Mittal, to name them very clearly. These are firms that were previously put together by apartheid government's industrial policies, and more recently privatized. And so, but with the structure of the market has remained the same. In other words, they are big dominant players in these markets. And of course, we can't make this point enough, is that high prices at that level means that you're not developing a manufacturing sector, and it's the development of the manufacturing sector that's going to result in job creation. And so it's kind of unblocking these prices is a very important thing for the development of the economy as a whole. And so in this sector we have a number of cases. Some of them people would be familiar with: the steel case against Mittal that the chairperson has previously spoken about, the Sasol cases, which people are familiar with because they've reported in newspapers. We're talking here about polymer chemicals There's a lot of scrap metal, wire cases in the wire market, plastic pipes, tires, rubber, piped gas. All of these are the kinds of cases we're dealing with in this sector. Then in infrastructure and construction markets, the point's been made around, there's over 840 billion rand being spent on infrastructure development. Anti-competitive prices increases the cost to government and ultimately the taxpayer. And this is it. In this area, there's a number of bidding markets here. You know, if you're involved in infrastructure development and construction, there's you bid for projects, and we have noticed in these markets that there's a fairly high prevalence of bid rigging occurring. In other words, instead of competitive bidding occurring, these companies are getting together and privately deciding who will win a particular contract and who won't. And this is a subject of a number of corporate leniency policy applications that we've got in the recent past. So people are now telling on each other essentially that, you know, we were colluding with this or other person around a particular contract. And so here we've got a number of cases in a number of different sectors: cement, concrete, plastic pipes, glass, bricks. In terms of the product market, but also a number of kind of cases in terms of the bidding process, in terms of the awarding of tenders. And then finally, the sector that specific questions were asked about is the financial sector. And here, everybody will recall that there was a banking inquiry that was held between August 2006 and June 2008. That banking inquiry produced a report that was released in December 2008. Now, a very unfortunate thing happened here, because our report was released in December 2008. In November 2008, the world was hit with the most serious financial sector crisis ever. Okay, we're still reeling from that. And so our report got released right at the time that this financial crisis hit the world. And there were a number of sensitivities around that, because, you know, we had the Minister of Finance saying, look, you know, we can't be raising questions around the integrity of South Africa's financial system in this climate. It's going to kind of, you know, how these kind of market sentiment works, and we've got to be careful around how we go about doing that. So while the Commission started off quite kind of, you know, determined and confident in this area, there was a set of circumstances outside of our control that kind of resulted in us, I think, kind of being much more careful around how we put forward these ideas and advance them.
I'm not doing the job.
Beg your pardon, sorry?
You're not doing your job.
No. So what we've done is, the bottom line of all of these, and this is a very big point because it relates to a number of other points that people have spoken about, the bottom line of most of the recommendations around the banking inquiry relates to the way in which the sector is regulated. And in order to fix most of these problems, what needs to be fixed is the way in which the sector is regulated, which is the job of the Department of Finance and the South African Reserve Bank, and which is something we sometimes don't have jurisdiction over, because that's regulated by a separate authority. So although we've identified competition problems in this area, we know that solving these problems means that we need to work very closely with the regulator in this area. And so we formed a joint structure together with National Treasury and the Department of Finance to look at how we go about implementing the different recommendations that came out of the banking inquiry. This structure comprises ourselves, Treasury, the DTI, and the Reserve Bank. We've met consistently over the last year or so. We've kind of looked at all the recommendations, and a lot of work has been done around this, and that has culminated in, as pointed out, in the Minister of Finance making the statement he did in his budget speech. And I think there's an acknowledgement there that the leadership in fixing these problems will come from the Department of Finance and National Treasury. Okay. I mean, there were a number of issues. As
are you aware that you have been responding to the first question?
Yes, I am. I am aware.
Not all of
it. That's why I asked halfway through whether I'm a, you know, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Let's move on then.
Yes, please.
Okay. In terms of the cell phone industry, once again, here what we have is we have a situation where there is a sector-specific regulator in ICASA, and there's the Competition Commission, and the sector-specific regulator works off its own mandate in terms of its own law and policy governing it, and we have a role to play around this as well. And in the hearings that were held last year, I think a big point that we made is that a number of complaints that we get and we are asked to deal with are actually as a consequence of the failure of that sector being regulated properly in the first instance. So in other words, to just put it plain and simple, if those call termination rates were beset a long time ago, we wouldn't be sitting with the number of complaints we are sitting with right now, with kind of problems around whose jurisdiction this is and isn't. And here, I just want to kind of go to some of the later questions, because there is a question, there was a question asked is why are expectations a challenge? There was a question asked, why don't we catch ExCom? Okay? I think it's important, this is a very important thing, and that is, you know, why expectations are a challenge is because people put completely unrealistic, unrelated expectations on an institution like the Competition Authority. There's things we can't do because the law doesn't allow us to do it, but we are asked the question, why aren't you dealing with telecommunications? Well, we aren't because there's a regulator that deals with telecommunications. You know, ESCOM has its own regulations around how that sector is regulated. And as with the banking problem. So in other words, we end up in a situation where...
Can I interject there?
Yeah.
Because I thought maybe that's the reason you should then publicize your work.
Right.
I think that should be a challenge rather than expectations, because expectations come as a result of your, you know, people lacking knowledge of the type of work you're doing and your parameters, how far can you go and so forth. I think that is something that you should clarify, unlike expectations.
Okay, and you notice that the third of our three strategic priorities relate precisely to that, because that is the big issue that's coming up. Okay, I think that is a big point, and if I don't answer all the other questions, that's the point. It goes to what this committee should be doing as well. And the big point is that the government has a whole arsenal of different policy instruments and tools that it can use, that it must use each one of these tools appropriately and wisely. It mustn't use a blunt tool to deal with an issue. It must find the sharpest tool it has. And often we are not the sharpest tool, but we kind of push to the front to kind of deal with some of these issues. And quite frankly, a lot of these issues are like political questions. They're political calls that have to be made around policy. Those have to be made, you know, by the appropriate place in government. So one of the things to answer that question very clearly, what this committee could do is this committee should make the connections around the complementarity between different government policy instruments and ensure that each one of them are used appropriately and properly, and the sharpest one is used to deal with the problem most appropriately. Okay, regarding the question around the FIFA World Cup, as you know, we have we have a case around the airline tickets. You know, the difficulty here is that all of those restrictive practice cases we have is the bad thing must have happened already for us to prosecute the bad guys. We can't say, look, you are planning to do something, we're going to prosecute you for planning to do something. We can't say, well, you know, and we've got to have the evidence that something has happened ex post in order to proceed with the case. And even though in the case of the airlines, for example, there's been lots of anecdotal evidence, there's been lots of talk in the newspaper that is going on, we can only take a stand when we have something real to work off. And of course, we are mindful of that and we pay attention to that. But once again, the other kind of job for a committee like this, for example, is that I think around issues relating to the FIFA World Cup, and I think post our announcement some of this has happened, I think the tourism authorities in this country need to kind of clearly understand what all of these practices are resulting in, because the point has been very well made that a short-termism in this industry, where, you know, people wanting to make a quick buck in a short period of time, is going to work against us in the long run. And I think there is a kind of acknowledgement around that more generally. There was a very interesting point around deterrence and the costs and weighing up the costs that we put in and whether it's sufficient deterrence. And I think that's a very valuable point. That's something we kind of engage with all the time. You know, are our fines sufficient deterrence? And, you know, I'm not sure what else to say about that except to kind of accept that point and say it's something that we kind of need to be engaging with all the time consistently. That's a question we must ask ourselves all the time. Okay, there was a question around staff retention. And here, let me just say that what you saw as the first point in the set of strategic priorities was a set of strategic priorities for the period 2006 to 2009. So these are old plans. We put that up front as an important issue in recognition of all the points that people have made there. I believe that's something we have been very successful at. I think that staff in the competition authorities are very happy staff generally. And as an indicator of that, I should point out that in the last 2 years in a row, the Competition Commission won the best company to work for in the private sector, in the public sector award that has been put forward by Deloitte. Okay, I think we put a lot of energy into training our staff and ensuring that they're skilled and equipped to do their jobs properly. So I don't think that's an issue. I think that, you know, we've reconciled ourselves to the fact that in an organization like ours, with a lot of young people coming in that are highly skilled technically, you must expect a certain amount of turnover, and we work with that. We have a fairly successful graduate trainee program where we pull people out of university and give them their first working experience, and a lot of them stay over in the organization. So in a sense, a lot of people who are sitting in the competition commission, we've grown ourselves from pulling them directly out of university and training them. There was a question around the CLP, and yes, you know, while there's an acknowledgement that this is like a good thing, it does stick in the throat, as the past chairperson of the tribunal has put it, does stick in the throat that the bad guy gets off scot-free through the CLP. And I can see the point around, well, surely a little bit of punishment is appropriate here. But what we found is that something like the CLP, because of all the kind of issues surrounding it, the legal issues, the certainty issues, that what is very important for its administration is that there must be complete clarity around how it gets implemented and how it gets used. And so one of the points of complete clarity, so if you're a business person and you want to come and be a whistleblower, you must be 100% sure that in doing so, you will indeed get the leniency. There won't be a half measure. There won't be that the authority won't change its mind somewhere along the line. That the sharp, its effectiveness is around the clarity of how it gets implemented, and we've had to give clarity around people not being prosecuted if they do it, and that's why I think it's worked, because we've made it so clear. But I mean, the point around the unfairness sometimes of the fact that, you know, the big dominant firm comes and gets the leniency and the smaller firms that are part of the cartel perhaps have to pay the fine, that is an unfortunate thing. I mean, I think in constructing this, we imagined that it would be the smaller firms, not the SAFOs and the big firms, that come and get their leniency, but in reality it's worked the other way around, which I think is a lesson perhaps for smaller firms to use this facility more than the bigger firms do. There's a whole range of questions around mergers, which I'll ask a moment to answer. I hope I've answered your question around the food prices. Pharmaceutical, you know that in the pharmaceutical industry, one of our big high-profile cases was around collusion for intravenous.
Sorry, Commissioner, can you address the chair?
Sorry. In the pharmaceutical sector, we've had a very high-profile case around price fixing in relation to intravenous solutions, which was successfully prosecuted. But I think that we're not aware of any other issues in that sector, but of course the fact that it could happen once means that it could happen again, and we would watch out for that. I'm not sure about our work in short-term insurance. This is also a sector that's regulated outside of us. It's got its own regulator. But I can say around Astral Foods is we have a number of cases relating to various different stages in the poultry industry, from broilers to eggs to, we have a number of different cases dealing with that, but in the value chain dealing with that matter. Hopefully I've answered the question around those industries that are protected by regulation. And the question around rent and budget, I'm not sure. I don't really answer that.
I think what you must do, try to answer those questions which were directed to the Competition Commission. And if you feel some belong to the tribunal, take those which you think they belong to you, and then we'll be able to check when we are finished to say, but you did not respond on this and that.
Very, very quickly though, I think 2 weeks ago we sent 600 copies of our signature plan to Parliament. I'm not sure when I have to do this.
We have tabled, we have to our minister, new minister, sent a strategic plan, our entire strategic plan document to Parliament. And my understanding was it was going to come to this committee prior to this meeting. So somebody needs to see where those documents are. As has the tribunal, I think. The tribunal has also sent their strategic plans.
Was it sent directly to Parliament or through the minister?
It was sent to Parliament, that's where we posted it, but the request came through the minister.
We'll check, we'll find out as to why was it not sent to us.
Just on that particular point, I understand that I think the difficulty was that the strategic plans are being drawn up by the Commission and the Tribunal, were drawn up for the DTI in 2009, are therefore drawn up in the form that the DTI wanted. They were not drawn up for the Economic Development Department. And they've not had a chance to interact with us on those plans. In a sense, they represent what the DTI wants in its view of the world. And that may have some bearing as to whether that can be tabled at this stage as an ED sanctioned plan. And so I simply asked that perhaps the chair can liaise with our ministry on that respect. So they were not drawn up for the ED, they were drawn up for the DTI against the DTI's objectives at that time.
Okay, we'll investigate that and check also with Parliament what's the record in that, because if it was said that they should be submitted irrespective of, there's an understanding, they should be submitted on due date during that period. And if there are any corrections to be made, they could be tabled before the committee. But in terms of submission timelines, they have to be adhered to. But thanks for the clarity. I think we'll pursue that separately. Thank you.
Finally, Chair, before I hand over to the Tribunal Chairperson, there was a question about whether, what is the relationship is between the Commission and Tribunal regarding one overspending and the other underspending. And the short answer to that question is there is no relationship because we function as completely independent institutions. So we don't kind of compare our budgets and that to each other. And Norman has explained why they have, the other short answer to the question is that 1 year's, you know, 1 year's underspending is the next year's surplus. I think that's the answer, one of the answers to one of your questions, why are we using different terms that this year's underspending is next year's surplus. And the point that I think Norman's been trying to speak about is the long process one has to go through in terms of the MTEF to retain your surpluses. There's certain things you've got to, there's certain criteria you've got to reach around that. But I think that in terms of, and then a related question was around the accountability of the DTI grants that we get. The grants we get from DTI, of course, we get through the MTEF process, and we are accountable for that money in the normal course, in other words, in terms of the PFMA. Thanks. Those are my answers. I mean, if there's anything I've left out, please, thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. We will we'll check when the competition tribunal, when it did not touch, we will go back to those questions which we think you were supposed to respond. Thank you.
Chair, with your permission, if I may deal with the answers so thematically rather than
the individual. If I leave something out, please draw that to my attention. If I can first just deal with the financial issues and the plan. I think we've mentioned that we've lodged the plan with Parliament as requested, but because it was a DTI plan, there's an issue taken up with our line of our future line department, shall I say, as to why you haven't given that. But speaking from our point of view, we have no difficulty in you seeing that plan. In fact, prepared our slides on the basis that you have it before us. So I'm not surprised, therefore, that some issues you've asked about, and you're saying, well, what do you mean by this? And that takes me, I think, to the issue of surplus, which a number of people have asked. I think Shannon's explained our use of the term has been an unexpended part of the budget, and we refer to it as surplus, and we've, in a sense, done it in our correspondence with the Treasury as well. And one of the things that you would have seen if you had our strat plan before you is that we've indicated that this year we've got a grant of $13 million from the DTI, and that in addition to that, to fund our rest of our activities, the Treasury gave us permission to use $19.8 million of call it accumulated unexpended part of the budget, or surplus, as we tell us in our correspondence, to fund the rest of our budget. So that's why we've used the word surplus, and that's why it's come up in that way.
I just want us, you know, I can see we continue with the surplus. Is that the money that was not committed? Was it not committed?
I'm not sure that I'm actually following your point of uncommitted. We received the budget, we received income, and there was unexpended money at the end of the particular year, and that accumulated over the various years. And there was a surplus, and there was an issue with Treasury as to what do you do with the surplus, and that's been going on. Eventually, this particular year, they said that money that has become a surplus that was unexpended, you may now use this ongoing year.
Or it became a surplus in your coffers?
Yes, in our coffers, that's correct.
Was it then term surplus by the, is that the correct wording that the Treasury?
Put it this way, yes, we've used that in our correspondence. I'm no accountant, but in terms of correspondence, we refer to the
No, I just want to, because you keep on referring to it and motivating on the surplus,
yes.
Because you see, it means you received money, you received a grant, you did not utilize that money,
yes.
For what you intended to utilize it for, and then you kept that money the following year, it accrued to the next financial year, and as it accrued, you did not spend that money again.
Yes.
It accrued to the other years. Why is it a surplus when that money could have been utilized? It was needed for some. It was needed elsewhere. So you asked.
Yes.
That's correct. We now, as I said, we see.
But I don't think Treasury could have agreed to turn that.
Mr. Chairman. Equal right of interjection, Mr. Chairman. No, this entire discussion proceeds from an erroneous premise. Usually, when you're dealing with an organ of state, underspending is bad. They've given the money, a job to do it. They're not spending the money. They haven't done the job. In their case, it's different. In their case, underspending is good. Because their job is a function of who knocks at the door. If they can do the job with... the more people knock at the door, the more money they make. So the approach that has been used in this discussion that just does not apply to the type of institution and the statutory nature of this body.
Honorable Rumbles, I think that's a different argument. it's a different discussion, because if you do not agree, we may come up with different thinking and suggestion. Maybe let's park it, and because we can give it a certain time if we want to debate that. Honorable, that's it.
Yeah, everything. I do understand the rollover. But one chapter to ask if the progress or objectives for the 2023 financial year were all implemented according to plan.
Can I just get back to what I said?
But we are doing the same thing which I prevented the Ambrose in, to say, let's not to go to that argument. Let the presenter try to explain without interjecting and correcting him to say what do we think. Okay.
Can I get back to saying that? My one take-home message is the issue of surface here is to how it comes about is not something that the committee needs to be worried about as being underperformed. There's two reasons that it comes about. One is we're getting more money as a result of mergers. Mergers bring in, they're big filing fees for mergers, and we have a formula with the commission which we share that money. In a year in which there's a lot of merger activity, that figure will be very high. And so, therefore, we will get a surplus as a result of something we can't anticipate. We don't tell people out in the private sector as to whether merge or not merge. It's an entirely private decision, and that's as it should be. The second is, I indicate, because we're an adjudicative body and we hear cases, and cases themselves, we are reactive in that way and unpredictable, they may settle. Nothing wrong if a case settles, which would have taken 20 days for the commission then to get agreement. That's good and well, but it simply means that our income and expenditure are never going to be exact. We are not a project-based organisation in that way. And therefore, we're going to be prone to that either surplus or deficit in any given year. But given the size of our budget, not particularly large, and the reasons for that, we don't think there's a problem there. So let me then get on to move off to finances and on to the substantive issues that haven't been answered. I think there were questions arose around mergers and whether we take, as I understand it, what we call public interest issues into account in a merger. In other words, do we simply look at mergers from a purely competition ground? The answer is we don't. We are mandated by the Act to look at public interest grounds as well. And when we're looking at a merger, we must look at the impact on employment that comes up in many cases and has come up quite recently. And we've often imposed conditions on mergers that relate to the effects on employment. In other words, setting a prohibition on the either merger-related retrenchments in a particular year or a number exceeding a certain amount. We particularly take seriously whether people have negotiated with their trade unions around retrenchments which they are obliged to do under the Act. But we also look at other issues. We look at the impact on small businesses, and we look at the impact on black on BE business as well. All those factors we take into account in mergers, and we must do so. Then we were asked about the relationship. What is the purpose of us being mergers? What is its impact on the economy, and how does it relate to the other stuff that we're doing? And I often use a medical analogy. The reason that we do mergers, historically, in fact, merger control was not part of a competition authority's activity. And what was the result? People who were colluding merged. You could no longer get them for collusion because they had now merged. Or people who couldn't get to a dominant position merged and got to a dominant position. So I use the analogy that if prohibitive practices are the antibiotics of the system, trying to deal with the illness once it happens, the purpose of merger control is vaccine of the system. We try to prevent a market structure becoming conducive to either a cartel activity or an abuse of dominance, and hence we regulate mergers upfront. You know, what people have to do is that before they can implement the merger, they must notify the competition authority. We look at that merger, and if we give it the red light, they may not go ahead with the merger. Some well-known examples: Sasol and Engine wanted to merge, we said no. The J&D Group and the Ellerans Group in the furniture market wanted to merge, and we said no. As a result, we think if we say no to a merger, we will keep the market from being being more competitive than it might be. Sometimes, however, we'll allow a merger to go through. We think it's problematic, but we'll say, sell off this division, and that will restore competition in the market. So we'll try not, if we can, not to stop a merger, and not to stop people going from there, but if we can introduce a condition to it that will improve the problem, we'll do that. Most mergers, however, because they're not inherently unlawful activity, do not create a problem, but they have to be notified. You see, if you meet the legal definition of a merger, which is related to turnover size and to whether there's been a change of control, you must notify. So the reason that you're seeing these very high figures of approval is that most mergers do not raise a competition problem and hence get approved. Why in some years do we stop more than others? I'm not sure that I know the answer to that. There may just be that people will see in a particular year, nothing got stopped, let's take our chances. I don't know. It's really up to people who do the mergers as to whether they want to do them in a particular year or not. So it's hard for us to gauge that reason or not. I don't know if Ambrosini asked us about the sort of lease arrangement that we have in the campus. The answer is that we pay money to the DTI, who then pay it to a company called the EDC, who own the premises and have a long-term lease. That arrangement we cannot take much further. We are obliged to be there. I understand from economic development that they're also going to settle on the same campus, and so a similar arrangement is likely to continue in the future. But as to the arrangements between the line department and the landlord, we can't take any further. We don't have anything to do with it. We don't have a lease directly with the landlord. He also asked us in relation to the IDC. I mean, there were some questions about whether the IDC was engaged in activity or benefited from concentrations in the economy. I can't comment on that more generally, only to say that the IDC is subject to the Act like any other company. The IDC contravenes the Act, notwithstanding that they are one of our cousins in the same institution. They must comply with the Act, and they will have to apply. I think on a more positive way of looking at the IDC, and I think that's the way the economic development wants to look at them, is that the IDC, in a sense, can somehow bring its development funding in line with what the competition authorities can do. We can only deal with a failure in the market if there has been a prohibitive practice or we're dealing with a merger. But if a market is concentrated but there are no prohibitive practices, and it's concentrated because barriers to entry are very high, development funding institutions can come in and assist firms who want to get into that market and are able to compete. Now, I think to the extent that there's some alignment between what the ED wants to do between these institutions that's taking over, I think there's a lot of scope for those development finance institutions to be liaising with bodies like the Commission, saying these are the areas where there's concentrations where we need entry. We're not seeing a prohibitive practice, so we can't do anything about it in our part of the institution. But you guys can fund some guys who want to enter into this market. Finally, we were asked about what challenges, in a sense, can we sort of put before this committee about things that perhaps can grab your attention and need to be thought about. And I think one comes back to General Babata's point about whether it is under enforcement. And like Commissioner Rambriot, I'm not sure that I know the answer to that question. I think we may need a longer history of enforcement to know whether we are under-enforcing or not. It's an open debate. But one of the things I think that we would be agreed upon now that is not working is that the fine is confined to a maximum of 1 year's turnover in terms of the current legislation. Cartels typically last for much longer than 1 year in duration. And sometimes the cartels that have been found out have been in existence longer before the Act actually even started. In fact, one of the people who actually pleaded guilty to one of these charges famously came to our hearing and said, "I would like to point out that this cartel started before I went to school." He's now the CEO of the company. He's coming along protesting, saying, "I had nothing to do with it." But it gives you an example of how long they can be. One of the weaknesses in the legislation is that we can only fine people for one financial year. And that, I think, I would agree, under-enforces against a long-term cartel. And it's something that perhaps the committee could look about. I know that when the DTI committee looked at the amendments in criminal enforcement, we have made that suggestion that they prefer to go the criminal enforcement route. than doing that. That remains as a problem in the Act that can be looked at. The other challenge is, and I don't have an answer for it, I can just simply give you an impression. The money that comes from fines, that we find, the fines are very heavy. They're probably heavier than in any other regulated sector, or even the criminal sector. Go to the National Revenue Fund. They don't go to the competition body. Otherwise, we would really have a surplus problem to bring you here, second to none. So they don't go to us. But if you look at, and I can only give you anecdotal evidence of people who phone radio stations or who have blog sites, the public are unhappy with that. The public feel that somehow, in a sense, the victims should be redressed more directly than the money going to the National Revenue Fund. So it's an issue to be thought about, because there's no simple answer to it. You can never, as it were, give money back to the exact victims, because A, you don't know who they are. B, you don't know to what extent, in a competition case, although the price was too high, how much high it was, so therefore how much should they have in their pocket. And it has the danger of forcing competition enforcement authorities into redistribution, which is not something they are particularly well geared to do. But it is a controversial issue in the public. Every time we have a fine, instead of people saying, rah, rah, these chaps are doing a good job, there's a lot of anger about this. And I've noticed this over time. And it's something the commission may, the committee may want to think about in terms of reform, in terms of engaging Treasury about this. Are there more creative ways to deal with this problem? So those are the two issues and challenges I'd like to deal with.
Yeah, and thanks, Commissioner. I think let's find out for those members who feel that they were not answered. Not those who were not satisfied. Those who think they were not answered their question. Can I see those who say there was a question which was not responded to? 3, 2, okay. Now, can we do the follow-up questions? Put your number one, number two, Ngonyama. Any other follow-up? Those two. Okay. Number one.
I'm quite worried about this thing of the bank charges and the way in which it was dealt with. And I think the most ridiculous thing is that the economic crisis was partly caused by the financial sector, and yet we say because there is an economic crisis, a global economic crisis, we shouldn't be or that we should halt the process of investigations and all of that. I think it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever had, that because there's a global economic crisis, which was mainly a financial crisis, or a crisis caused by financial institutions, and partly as a result of their laxity in terms of regulations, and some of the costs and the greed that, and I think we can go on and on and on about that, but I think that it's one of the things we've got to deal with quite urgently, and the fact that there is a process to deal with that already is quite exciting. And I think one of the things we'll have to do in the future, I propose, Comrade Chair, that we've got to get a report in terms of progress with regards to. Comparatively speaking, and I think it's we yet to dispute that information. South Africa charges the highest in the world in terms of bank charges. It's something that we have to urgently look at. We've got to relieve the thousands of South Africans who use these banks and the banks taking advantage And we've got to look at the four major banks, because those are the culprits. So that's the one point. The other point around the act, the amendments and all of that. The most ridiculous thing that happened last year was Tiger Brands is fined 90 billion rands, or was it a year before last? 90 billion rands. Huh? 90 million rands. Okay. And then about a month or two after that, they increased prices. Firstly, and secondly, of course, there was a concern about whether that constitutes the degree of, their contravention, you know. But I think that it was extremely ridiculous, and the fact that the Competition Commission had absolutely no powers to do anything about that, and given those price increases, obviously, Tiger Brands is laughing all the way to the bank, on the basis, having not only recovered the 90 million rands that the Competition Commission, had imposed on them. And I think one of the things relating to the amendments to the Act is that we've got to lock up people who commit these crimes. It's not enough to impose fines. We've got to lock up people who basically rob from the pockets of the poor. Standard, Tiger Brands, in terms of the commodities that they provide, it affects each and every family throughout this country, and a lot of small businesses collapsed as a result of their conduct and all of that, but all that they got was a fine, and I don't think that that's enough. And we really have to emphasize on this thing that people who are responsible for for price fixing, whether it happened long before they went to school or not, they've got to take responsibility. They've got to serve jail term. I think that that's the one thing that we've got to emphasize. I know that that has been one of the concerns that has been raised in the private sector around the amendments to the legislation. But theft is theft, whether it's committed by CEO of Tiger Brands or it's committed by an owner of a spaza shop. The fact that the fines goes into the national fiscus in terms of redistribution, I don't think that that's enough. And that we've got to find a way to stop these things. Over and above saying they must not do business, businesses and all of that as suggested earlier on, I think that they must do time. Thanks.
Yeah, maybe it would be, maybe we have to check the amendment on the Act, because I don't think we haven't seen that amendment. Maybe we're not sure whether that is built in there. We are at a disadvantage that we are not part of that amendment. So maybe to study and see whether
Well, my view is that we have to take a long-term view in our approach on some of these issues, in the sense that for us to be able to get deeper on the financial institutions, we cannot be content with the situation of getting the snippet of the information that we're getting from the Competition Commission, which to me is not part of their brief to brief us about the investigation on the financial institutions. But nevertheless, they just gave us a synopsis of some of the challenges. So, and as part of the issues that we have to address is the question of maybe inviting the investigator to come and brief us here as a portfolio committee in detail, so that we appreciate the points that the Honorable and Manamela is actually getting into, and then be in a position to suggest some of the interventions that we have to get into and to assist and the Competition Commission and the tribunal. And I fully agree that we have been held at ransom as a South African society by the financial sector in South Africa. They've creamed it all the way because there's been a bit of a reluctance in touching financial sector. And therefore, it's about time that if we're truly, that is the long-term part that I was referring to, Chair, that if we're truly to ensure full participation by the marginalized, we have to ensure that the price of money is put at the level and the participation of people within the finance and the economy is put at the level where people, and they can find it easy to participate within the economy. And at the present moment, if you look at the bank charges, everything, and it's fully the full preserve of the financial sector. There is no proper regulation mechanism that are there to monitor and actually and ensure that whatever irregularities have been exposed. The second issue that I want to latch on this long-term view that I'm referring to is again the point that Mr. Norman, you referred to on the broader issues that you take into consideration as you and deal with the cases. In my own view, it doesn't come across, Chair, that the matters relating to empowerment, gender participation, and various other issues and of that nature are profiled and during the cases. During the cases, what really gets profiled is ensuring that there is a matter relating to pricing, for instance, and collusion around question of prices and so on, and the fact the long-term issues of transforming the economy don't actually get a strong profiling as part of the consideration. For instance, let me cite an example. The commissioner is actually taking us through prioritization criteria. As part of prioritization criteria, you have 1, 2, 3, 4 areas that you refer to. The one that would actually be very close to what I refer to as long-term and the issue is the question of impacting on low income. Otherwise, the rest is really matters relating to various other issues. So my issue is that this is a very important issue because we can't be talking about curbing monopoly and sort of anti-competition and in the space. Otherwise, we'll be going for short-term goals, Chair. It's short-term goals. We are going to count cases that we've won and the amount of money that we've managed to recoup. But what is the impact in the long term, in the transformation of the economy, and giving space and for lower-level participants to come on board? And it's a very, very crucial issue, and, well, it may be that, and again, it may come to the question of the mandate, and I don't know whether it comes to that, and again, I concur with your point, Chair, that maybe also the question of the amendments, and we have to look at that as well, but my view is that we have to take a long shot on some of these issues. My gripe in everything that is the fact that the empowerment, gender and so on, they don't actually come up very, very strongly as matters that I consider. Question of the intermediate industrial product, very, very important. Because they shrink the economy. If there's no space and that is given because of high prices, for instance, of steel and so on, so lower and the sort of participants that can actually come in are not able to come in because of that collusion at that level. And so maybe it may be that, again, the point that we raise in check and what oversight specifically that is required of us, maybe these are some of the companies that we have to get into, or maybe specifically we pick up one or two cases and go deeper on them. Steel industry, financial institution, go deeper on them. Then on the basis of that, we use that as a pilot project and on the interventions that we need to do. Thank you.
Yeah, I think, Honorable Ngonyama, you're right, but we must know that the competence of Parliament is to legislate.
So sometimes we are shooting the message instead of as the parliament to look how can we do things so that they can perform in and smart. Honorable Protest, or you covered. On your responding, you respond and try to have the parting shot, because after you will give Honorable Coleman to give us the way forward and the parting shot.
Thank you, Chair.
Or you want to open up some? Okay.
There was a report about SAA and the other airlines in Southern Africa, and how SAA, because they fixed their prices, had basically led to the collapse of, or rather the reducing of traffic from other Southern African airlines. I think Zambia was affected, Botswana was also affected, and all of that. Now, the question I have is, do we look also at the impact that South African companies have, across the borders, or do we only look at, how they affect other companies trading in South Africa? And if that's not the case, is there an institution at an international body that looks into such cases? Because it would be quite worrying for a South African company to basically lead its action leading to job losses and all of those things in Southern African regions. Thanks.
Yes, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. The first question is around banking, and I take all the points that I've made. I mean, I think that we do deal with the sector in a very sensitive way, and perhaps there are good reasons to do that. I want to assure this committee, though, that the banking inquiry recommendations, we've proceeded along that path. We, as evidenced by the Minister of Finance's statement in the last speech, where he's keen now, he's on board to kind of ensure that at least the spirit of those recommendations are seen to in some way or the other. And just to say, the sharp issue here is that, as I pointed out, this is a regulated sector, and the mandate of the regulators in the financial sector is to deal almost exclusively with what they call systemic risk, right? So they deal with contagion. They want the whole system to be intact. Our interest in it is for the system to be more consumer friendly, okay? And we are having to persuade them that those two things are not mutually exclusive. Because historically and all over the world, that's how financial banks regulators think. They only think around systemic risk and those issues, and we're coming in now asking them to consider other policy issues that they're finding it difficult, and there's a difficulty for them to tune into those other policies. But I think that's the big message for a committee like this. That I think it would be a really good idea for a committee like this to kind of have a more detailed briefing, as has been suggested, and kind of deal with this thing in more detail. But just I need to point out that that's the sharp issue. The sharp issue is that historically we have regulation in this industry, in this sector, dealing with systemic issues. Risk issues, and what the call is now is for there to be a more consumer focus around this, and that those two things might be. In other words, the question is, should the mandate of the Reserve Bank be changed to include taking into account competition issues and not just dealing exclusively with the systemic risk issues? The Okay, so at the point, I think that the answer to the question around jail time is the amendment of the Competition Act does now provide for jail time. What this does, though, is it creates a much more complexity around the way in which we operate and the way we investigate and the way in which enforcement agencies relate to each other, and that's a point that I have made in the course of my presentation, that that's one of the challenges in the next period. There's one point that's been made here, and I want to just take the gap now and say what perhaps I've been saying much too diplomatically all along. I do often find myself in a situation where I'm getting shot as a messenger. I do. I mean, it happens way too often. And I need to say categorically here that a lot of the issues that people are wanting the commission to do is not our responsibility. I mean, the questions around legislation, around the long-termism issue, that's the long-term issue is an issue for this committee. It's a political issue. I'm the bureaucrat. I'm given an act and I'm said, go and implement this act. The questions that are being asked here are very, very valuable questions, and we would want to engage in those discussions, but they're not primarily our responsibility. These are bigger political questions around what gets regulated, whether price fixing is a good thing or a bad thing, whether we should be putting putting a cap on the bread prices. All of these issues are completely outside the powers we have, but it's not completely outside the powers of this committee. So I think that's the gap I'm taking. That this acknowledgement is a good one for me. That is, we welcome the engagement, but one has to understand what our limitations as an institution is. And then finally, the question around other African countries, I think it's a good one, because that is increasingly in the last period, the Commission has done a lot of work around its interaction with other African countries. We've hosted we do a lot of capacity building work. We host officials from other agencies for periods of time. We do training. When we do training, we invite them to our training courses. And in fact, there are a number of initiatives, one that I'm going to at the end of this week, to get better coordination between African competition agencies. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner. Can we give to Commissioner Norman Manuel?
I just responded to two things. One is a question that I didn't deal with and rose out of my presentation. There are various firms that were mentioned as having cases before us this year, and we asked if that an indication of the failure of corporate governance of those firms. I just want to say very carefully that the fact that firms are being charged by the Commission is, in any case, the Commission believes they have a case against these firms. It doesn't mean that they have not got a defence, and in all these cases, the firms have a defence. And our job as an adjudicator is to decide whether the firm's defence is valid, in which case they will be acquitted. So the fact that firms are being charged doesn't indicate that there's necessarily corporate governance failure or anything like that. We have to wait till the outcome of the case, and then you will see our decision, and we will give our reasons for that. So the mere fact that people are being charged is no indication that something has gone wrong. Simply a case that the prosecutor feels that they've done something wrong, and after the investigation, they decide to charge it. It goes no higher than that. The other issue was on the question of mergers and why the public interest in mergers cases doesn't get the emphasis that these economic issues are. I think the reason is that the merger activity is a fairly modest one. If a merger is very good for the public interest, we're not likely to, and there's no economic problem with a merger, then we're not going to stop that merger, it will go ahead. So even if it's been very good for the public interest, it won't come into the news because we've approved that merger, and if it doesn't harm the economy, good for the public interest, well, that's a bonus. We can, under the Act, allow a merger to go through if it's bad, if it's anti-competitive, but for good for the public interest. That has never happened in our history, but in theory, you could have a merger that might be, let's say, very bad, lead to sort of market power, but be very good for employing, for these people to take on more jobs. In theory, that could happen. It hasn't happened in actual terms. But ultimately, mergers, we're in a position of either encouraging or discouraging mergers. It's entirely a private sector-driven activity. So therefore, whether as a result of mergers, certain social issues are being promoted or less promoted is not going to be something that under merger policy we could be doing much about. If there is a substantial impact as a result of a merger, that impacts on the public interest that we can recognize, we could change that. But it's so seldom that happens that it's going to make much difference. And merger activity is not something that is very good for dealing with. Let me give you an example. When Sasol and Engen merge, Sasol said, even if you find this merger anti-competitive, this is going to be very good for empowerment because we have certain consortium here who are empowerment shareholders and they will have oil industry. But the people who objected to the merger were the other oil companies. And they said, excuse me, we also have empowerment partners and they're going to be adversely affected by this merger. It's going to have adverse effects on empowerment. So in a sense, the empowerment issue became neutralized because both those before the merger and those against the merger were claiming that it would have that impact on them, but one for and one against. So it is not really a good mechanism, as would be tender policy or other policies, for instance, dealing with these issues in their extreme form if we can, with the employment we can, but otherwise it's going to be an issue on which we are not terribly significant in dealing with the kind of the public interest issues. But in the rare cases that they are, the Act allows us to intervene.
Thank you, Chairperson. We are going to hand over to one of our callmen just to give us the way forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And just apologize for making your work difficult through interjections and so forth. Can I also thank the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal through the leadership from Mr. Ramboros and also Mr. Manon. Is it, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Absolutely correctly.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think you realize that as a commission we have an obligation to support you. But at the same time, we have an obligation also to understand you better. And in this, through the deliberations we had today, it was quite clear that we need more information. Hence the emphasis on your stretch plan documents, because they're going to assist us. But also any other relevant information that might assist the committee to help you to do your work. But also, we also have an obligation to check whether whatever programs you have in place are really impacting positively on the receiver. What is important is the end product. And we are not going to really be shy to do our work in that regard. What we also realize is there's a need for us to, especially on the financial side, because we are governed, both public, the departments and the public entities are governed by the same financial legislation. So it's important that when you use the terms in our report, we use the same terms, so that we don't argue unnecessarily over this term. So acclimatization of the work of the commission and the tribunal is quite important. And we feel that you need, through what the members were saying, were indicating here, we feel that you need really to strengthen your relationship with other agencies, especially the regulatory agencies. That will assist you in really speeding up the turnaround time in terms of the work before you, and making everybody happy, you know. And also, we'll give you an indication in terms of your shortfalls as to what you need to prioritize more in terms of your whether staff establishment or even if there's a need for additional funds or so. That would assist a great deal. And I think for the purposes of, doing away with silo practices, because that is not helping. You need to cooperate, we need to coordinate, we need to integrate our work as much as possible, irrespective of whether we're governed by separate legislations or what. But the legislation or what is important is we are serving the same public, and therefore we need to ensure that we cooperate with as many people that we're doing, common work as possible. We need you to urgently develop, if there's none, and implement, if there is, your communication strategy. It is important for the public to understand the type of work we are doing, how far you should go, or how far does your mandate go, so that they don't, bring unnecessary expectations to yourself. It's important that you implement that, if you have that strategy. Unfortunately, we don't know, because we haven't received your stretch plan. From our side, I think there's an urgent need to meet with the portfolio committee on finance to look at your last priority on financial sector, that is the report on banking inquiry. It is important that we deal with that. And also to get a progress report on, corrective measures that are put in place. The members have also indicated the need to look at the amendment. It is important, now that you are under economic development, it will be important that we look at that and we get we become knowledgeable of what that amendment is all about, and the Act in general. Understanding that sometimes you are given unnecessary expectations, even things that are outside your mandate, Mr. Ramboros, I think it's also important to note that those expectations come as a result of your work, and they are also meant to boost your work. So it is important that you do respond, because one of your response might be educational. For instance, you might educate people about the work that you are doing more, and also advise, because you have a responsibility to advise the minister, and through the minister advise the committee, because the more we know, the more we are able to assist. I think that is a, don't take it as a negative thing. It's also positive, in a sense that it's giving you a challenge, and it means you have to do more. And to me, that is quite important. I thought, Chair, that those are some of the issues that we agreed upon. Obviously, as we interact further, we will have more issues. But as of now, we'll investigate the issue of the stretch plan, and then be able then to see how do we handle that. Because I'm told here by the parliamentary liaison that there was a request to Parliament that the minister tables somewhere around June. I don't know whether the response was positive or not, but those are some of the things that we have to follow up on. And until then, you'll bear with us, because we'll be coming back for more information. And I think we need to close the budget process, having had those stretch plans, because we must be confident that the work going forward is within and is covered appropriately by the budget concerns. So we'll be following up on that. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Coleman. Commissioner, I was trying to assist you, but now you open up but by also following that what I was trying to assist you on. I was trying to protect him, but now he went back to the same predicament. I will say, members, I would like to thank you very much for participation, and I would like to thank the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal for taking us through. And our meeting is adjourned until the other day. Thank you.
Almost 3 hours, eh?
You don't know what call.